Some of you may remember a time when writing with your left hand earned you a stern glare from your teacher and sometimes even a hard thwack across your knuckles. Well, that's not likely to happen these days, but there still is something about being left-handed that brings with it a sense of difference and even mystery. Handedness and how we come to be left or right-handed, and sometimes both, is the subject of today's edition of Please Explain. Joining me now are John Krakauer, an associate professor of neurology and co-director of the Motor Performance Laboratory at Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons, and Robert L. Sainberg, an associate professor of kinesiology and neurology and the director of the Movement Neuroscience Laboratory at Penn State University. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
Dr. Sainberg, have we figured out what exactly makes someone right-handed or left-handed yet?
Well, to be accurate, I'd have to say that the jury is still out on that. And that's mostly because we don't have the smoking gun evidence in the form of a specific gene that's been identified or a set of genes that produces handedness. But there's been a lot of work from different arenas that has led to almost a consensus that there's a strong genetic determinant for right-handedness. And most of these ideas suggest that left-handedness is actually the lack or emerges from the lack of right-handedness.
So and there's an absence of the right-handed gene rather than a left-handed gene?
Right. So that left-handedness emerges from the lack of the genetic determinant for right-handedness, and there's a group of people that are usually referred to as non-right-handers, some of which are mixed-handers, and some of which develop handedness that looks like the opposite of right-handedness. There has been a guy named Klar, who's a geneticist in Maryland at the National Cancer Institute, recently came up with a very interesting model that's been, you know, very well elaborated, in which he noticed, actually interestingly, from hanging out at airports, that there seemed to be a relationship between handedness and scalp hair whorl orientation. And recognizing that hair whorl orientation is not something that's culturally developed, he got very interested in this, came up with a model of handedness, which seems to not only explain the distribution in the population, but also can predict the handedness in the offspring of monozygotic twins, which are people who have identical genome makeups, or the same gene plan.
He could have been very confused by the bald people who walked by, but that's why research is so difficult. Dr. Krakauer, is left or right-handed is something that's unique to human beings, or are other species also exhibiting left and right-handed preferences?
Yeah, that's a really, really hard question.
Well, we must watch apes doing
this. Yeah, exactly. It used to be thought until recently that human beings were unique in being handed at the population level. In other words, when you look at all humans, there's like a 9-to-1 ratio in favor of right-handedness. And that was what led, I think, initially to the belief that there was some relationship between language dominance and handedness, because language was unique to humans, therefore handedness was unique to humans. But more recent work would suggest that if you look at least chimpanzees, and that they do show what looks like population biases towards the right hand, that it isn't just task-specific. And then once you start going down that road and starting attributing handedness in non-human species to what, you know, Bob was sort of talking about genes for handedness, it begins to seem that lateralization is something ubiquitous all the way down to worms and fishes. And so whatever mystery we solve in terms of handedness will end up being something that is not just unique to humans, is my opinion.
Now, I can understand how a dog could be right paw or left paw dominant, but a worm? They don't have hands.
There, we're not talking about them having hands, obviously, but you can joke about that. But there are preferences. I was many years ago, I went to Costa Rica on a sort of ecological resort type holiday, and spider monkeys would come down every afternoon to see us in the trees, and they have these amazing prehensile tails, and they have preferences in terms of the direction that they will reach with their tails. Elephants have preferences with the direction they reach with their trunks, and so you don't have to have two arms to show evidence for preferences.
Is there a neurologist definition of handedness that might be different than mine, doctors?
All I can say is I think handedness is a very slippery term because it's based entirely on what kind of task you base it upon. And I think some of the controversies in whether non-human primates were handed or not could actually be based on the types of tasks that were used to check for it. And it seems that the more complicated the task, the more likely it is you may begin to see differences. And so I would say that my definition of handedness would be based on what Bob's beginning to show with his research about, you know, real subtle differences between the dominant and non-dominant arm.
Well, we have got an email from a listener who said, I'd love to understand why I'm right-handed dominant for certain tasks, that is, writing, using a knife, left-handed for others, hitting a softball, swinging a golf club, and perfectly comfortable using both hands for things like painting.
Well, can I go back for a second?
Absolutely.
The comments about non-human handedness. There's been a lot of work recently. Leslie Rogers has been documenting lateralization in many, many different species. But it looks like up until the chimps and certain non-human primates, you don't really get a conservation across the population. So it's really in the chimpanzees that you start to see 70% of the population looking right-handed, which now, suggests a genetic origin.
That's 70%, so, but among humans, it's only 10 to 15% who are left-handed.
That's right, as though there's an advantage that's emerging, being conserved in the genome, and becoming extremely advantageous the higher up the evolutionary spectrum you go. I think it's right that animals show handedness, and there's been a lot of documentation of this. Mammals like dogs and cats so show pawedness, and we see this with our own pets. But the conservation across a population, or the tendency to show one-handedness across a bunch of different individuals in the population, really doesn't occur until chimpanzees. The issue of what handedness is a really good question. That's something that really hasn't been addressed very extensively in the early years of studying handedness. I think that lateralization, as John said, is certainly a ubiquitous feature of at least primate nervous systems. And I just want to point out something about handedness that makes it... that makes people think of it a little differently. I think that with handedness, we tend to use words like preference, as though we have a preference for which hand we want to use, like we have a preference for ordering chicken or beef on the menu. And I think that this kind of perspective leads us to think that it's not something that's sort of coded at the nervous system level. Lateralization of a motor function, if we think about it in terms of definition, the idea that you brought up that tasks are differentiated by whether we are left or right-handed, which hands we use for tasks, seems to be the way that people have tried to identify handedness for many, many years. So typically one asks, are you left or right-handed? And what you mean is, do you write with your right hand? Do you hold a fork with your right or left hand? Do you sweep with your right or left hand? But in fact, the work that we've been doing has been suggesting that it's not necessarily at the task level that we can best define handedness, but it's mechanical functions that we carry out with our hands. So that it looks like the right-hand left brain system has become specialized for controlling the dynamics of movement, for being able to anticipate the forces that you deal with as you move your arm. And the left-hand system has become specialized for stabilization, or something that we call impedance control. So, for example, if you were cutting a baguette with a knife, you will stabilize the baguette with your left hand, and you'll actively produce forces with the knife cutting the baguette with your right hand. Both of these tasks are very complex tasks, but each hand is specialized for its contribution to that task. And so if we look at a lot of the tasks that we tend to want to do with our non-dominant hand, those tasks tend to be things that have to do with stabilization.
I have to break in right now. Yeah. My guests are Robert L. Sainberg and John Krakauer. We're talking about handedness on Please Explain Today on WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, let me go to Dr. Krakauer for a second, because you've looked at how this actually works through what we know from imaging the brain. What do we see when we choose to lift a glass with our left hand, or swing a bat, or throw a ball?
Well, I mean, there are standard responses in the brain to using one arm or the other, or hand or the other. You know, we usually see more activation in the brain contralateral, in other words, the side opposite to the side you're using. There have been surprisingly few functional brain imaging studies of, you know, hand dominance or switching from one side to the other. I mean, the general feeling is that when you use your right hand, if it's your right hand that's dominant, you tend to activate mostly in your opposite hemisphere, whereas if you use your left hand, you see both sides activate more. That's sort of the general feeling from the functional imaging literature.
It might be interesting to image somebody who's a switch hitter in baseball to see if the brain lights up the same way.
There was a recent study, nothing to do with baseball. Don't talk to me about baseball. I know nothing about it.
Well, imagine a cricket player doing that.
But they did do it. There was a functional imaging study taking people who were right-handed, left-handed, who were forced to become right-handed. And you saw two types of brain change. It was very interesting. One change, you know, they got activations switching over to the left hemisphere, as you'd expect, because they now have to use their right hand. But they also saw an increase in activation in the right hemisphere when they used their right hand, a type of activation that they didn't see in people who were right-handed from birth. So in other words, there were sustained and increased changes in the brain on the side of the old left-hand planning. So it looked as though, even though you can switch and do quite well from an early age by switching over, there are sustained brain differences that show, in a sense, like a signature, that you were left-handed and you switched over to being right-handed. And I think that's very, very interesting, because I think it's sort of consistent with points that Bob makes, that it's not true, perhaps, that you can ever switch your dominance completely.
I think an interesting aspect of that differentiation of left and right hemisphere contribution to hand functions is the idea that if each hemisphere is contributing something unique to the control of movement, and each hand is accessing both hemispheres, then if we lose a hemisphere, then we will lose the function to both hands. And in fact, historically, we've thought, because of this fact that the left hemisphere tends to supply the right hand in terms of sensory motor function and vice versa, and because when people lose sensory motor function due to stroke in their left or right side, we tend to see paralysis on the opposite side of the body, we tend to think that that hemisphere doesn't contribute to movement. But it turns out, work that we've done and colleagues of ours, and lately some people all around the country have been doing, has demonstrated that patients who have a stroke in, for instance, the left hemisphere have persistent deficits in their left hand. And people that have a stroke in the right hemisphere have persistent deficits in their right hand. So the hand that they thought previously was their good hand, if you will, actually has difficulties that are interestingly predicted by a model of handedness in which one hand's stabilizing things and one hand's predicting forces.
Is there a difference between what's happening when we do things that require fine motor skills like sewing or writing and something that requires gross motor skills like throwing or catching a ball?
That's a really good question. And I think that I have sort of a, well, first of all, I should say that I don't think that we really know at this point whether handedness extends to all body segments and like the fingers and the elbow and the trunk, for instance. But I think that it's very likely that a lot of these fine motor things that we do are highly learned tasks. Stuff like writing may actually not be handed. I would suggest that maybe what actually writing is entrained to a particular hand, because when we start to play with writing activities with crayons and so forth when we're kids, we tend to stabilize our bodies with our non-dominant hand. Our dominant hand, we're using the bigger joints. We're holding that crayon or that writing implement with our with a big grasp, kind of like the way you'd hold a what would you hold, a broom or something. And you're really using your larger joints to do that writing. And it takes years and years to develop that behavior.
I think there should be...
It turns out that after you have a stroke that paralyzes your dominant side and you have to regain function with your... Basically, you have to use your non-dominant hand as your major controller. It turns out that those kinds of tasks, the fine motor tasks, are the ones that you can learn much better than things like throwing and big drawing behaviors and stuff like that.
And there's a paradox here, which I think is important to sort of bring to the fore because it can get confusing, is that on the one hand, you know, one could argue that you need to use fine motor skills to check for dominance. But on the other hand, from brain imaging standpoint and from studies in stroke, it's sometimes the fine control aspects that are lost. For example, if you look at functional brain activation, when you just squeeze your hand to generate a force, you tend to just activate the hemisphere contralateral to your hand. If, on the other hand, you have to sequence your fingers in a complex way, like perhaps when you play the piano, you activate both hemispheres. And we've also found recently in patients with very small strokes that just affect one hand ostensibly, that they have particular problems with the allegedly unaffected hand with the more complex task, but you can't find anything wrong with them when they're trying to generate force. So, you know, and going back to the idea of elephants and your tongue or things like that, or monkeys and their tails, they tend to bilaterally activate when they're using that single, a limb. So I think you mustn't confuse the idea of having a preference or a dominance for one limb with the idea that it means that only one hemisphere is involved in controlling it, that mapping is incorrect.
An uncle who grew up at a time when they forced you to become right-handed told me that he began to stutter and feel really anxious, and that went away when he was allowed to write with his left hand again. Is this connected to other things that happen in the brain?
Well, you have to decide
if we force people to
per se is having an effect on cognition or whether it's a marker for lateralization. In other words, there seems to be some computational benefit to lateralizing functions in one hemisphere or the other. And so if it turns out that being left-handed versus being right-handed is a marker for other forms of lateralization, I mean, when we say dominant hemisphere, maybe that's true, that one hemisphere becomes computationally dominant in your life versus the other, and your handedness is a marker for that. There was a survey done where they looked at art students, and there were far more left-handers amongst them than in the general population. So one has to be careful about the possibility of this being a marker versus itself being an indication. But what I do have to be careful about, and I think Bob will agree with this, is that the connection between handedness and language, I think, has pretty much been put on the back burner. I don't think people believe anymore that handedness is related to language.
We have to take a little break, and when we come back, we will be taking calls from our listeners. Our number here is 212-433-9692. We'll also find out why left-handedness has been a cultural taboo around the world, a bad thing. In fact, if you look at the French word for left, it's gauche, and it In Italian, it's sinistra, similar in Spanish. In Portuguese, canhoto, which means that the devil is involved. And in Mandarin, the word for left also means out of accord. My guests are John Krakauer and Robert L. Sainberg. The number 212-433-9692. We're back with Please Explain. My guests are John Krakauer, Associate Professor of Neurology and Co-Director of the Motor Performance Laboratory at Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons, and Robert L. Sainberg, an Associate Professor of Kinesiology, and why does that word have to be so hard to pronounce? Neurology, and the Director of the Movement Neuroscience Laboratory at Penn State University. Our number here, 212-433-9692. Before we get to those calls, I'm sure both of you have thought about this, but cultures all over the world since ancient times have come up with the same idea that left-handedness is a bad thing. Why do you think that is? In fact, I understand in one East Asian culture, it was once considered acceptable to break an arm to prevent someone from writing with the left hand.
Well, I mean, yeah. I'm sure Bob has it. I mean, just, you know, one of the interesting things about it is it makes you think that they're onto something, right? One thing that's interesting is that, you know, if you use handedness as a marker for lateralization, and, you know, I think there was a study in fishes where they looked at different species of fish, and they found population-level lateralization in those fishes that hang out with each other a lot versus fishes that tend to swim about on their own. And the example, I believe, was that when fishes have to shoal together in a large group and they approach a barrier, if they have population-level lateralization, they'll all turn left at the barrier in unison. Now, if you had one little fish in there that turned out that it wanted to turn right round the barrier, it would be, you know, a pariah, and it went in the wrong direction. It would ruin the formation, if you see what I mean. So there are theories now that you may see population-level lateralization, and in humans, population-level handedness, because it has something to do with the ability to stay cohesive socially in gregarious groups. Now, that's highly theoretical, but if it turns out to be true that there's some social cohesion, gregariousness, ability to stay in a community function to lateralization, then you can begin to understand why left-handers might get shunned, because it's a way of breaking the cohesion in the community, going all the way back to fishes, and it might be a residue, in a way, of that realization on the part of social animals.
You want to add to that, Bob, or should we go to the calls?
I think the calls would be great.
Okay, Gene from Westchester, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've always been curious whether there's a connection between dyslexia and non-discriminating left and right-handedness.
Because, Bob, you said earlier, was it you who said that a lot of artists are left-handed? A lot of artists are dyslexic as well.
Well, it was John that said
that. John.
I think there's been a lot of attempts to associate left-handedness with a lot of good and bad things. And so when you do stats, people have reported that there are more left-handers among geniuses, that there are more left-handers among profoundly retarded people, that handedness seems to be more prevalent with certain disorders. And as a matter of fact, some people refer to a theory of handedness, which is dysfunctional, so that handedness is a reflection of dysfunction.
One listener even asked if it's connected to being gay.
Sure, there's been studies that have shown statistical evidence that there's a higher prevalence of left-handedness in people that are gay. I think recently there's been some pretty strong evidence that there's a higher incidence of left-handedness in people that that have schizophrenia, which doesn't, by the way, mean that somebody who is left-handed has a higher likelihood of being schizophrenic. I don't think any of these associations can be really thought of as causal in the way that one would think of left-handedness producing any of these associations. I think that these are very weak associations for the most part, and it may be that there are some genotypes, some mixture of genes that leads to higher likeliness of left-handedness and also higher likeliness of other things. But I don't think there's been any convincing evidence for a strong causal relationship between handedness and any sort of function like reading capability, language capability.
And I think the point that Bob's making, which I think is very important, is that if it turns out, as it seems, that there's going to be some developmental, genetic, structural brain reason for being, let's say, right versus left-handed, then there may well be correlations between whatever made that structural change lead to handedness with that structural change leading to other traits. But it doesn't mean that the handedness itself is the cause, for example, of being dyslexic or gay. So, for example, if some, you know, somebody is gay and then the parents go, right, we're going to make our left-handed child right-handed, that's in no way going to stop that child from being gay. So it's a correlation, not a causal relationship.
Let's go to another call, Gregory.
Can I point something else out here? I want to bring out the fact that John before suggested that there was a possibly a computational advantage to lateralization, and that's something that's been shown for other systems. And the idea is that by doing some things in one hemisphere and other things in another, instead of duplicating them in both, that you actually have more neural circuits, more complexity available for each process. And so whether you're left or you're right-handed, there seems to be an advantage to handedness in itself in terms of coordination.
Gregory from New York City. Hi, you're on the air.
How are you doing? Well, first of all, I think you have a fabulous show, always thought-provoking. My question is that when I was younger, was going to school in Germany, dislocated my left hand and had to do all my schoolwork with my right hand or I would have failed. And in playing sports, there's a dominant. I can score with both legs, but I have for more like throwing. My throwing arm as center fielder would be my right arm, but my righting arm would be my left hand. And I'm curious what distinguishing characteristics there are, and what leads to these differences, and if that is more of a genetic thing, as you're mentioning, or non-handedness, or what are your thoughts about that ambidextrous person versus the left-handed person.
And before you go on, he's saying ambidextrous, you said mixed-handedness. Is there a difference between the two?
Yeah, there's a big difference between the two.
Would he be ambidextrous or would he be mixed-handed?
What you're describing, the way I understand what you said, what you're describing is you do some tasks with one hand that you prefer,
yes.
One hand, other tasks with another hand. That would be mixed-handedness. And this seems to describe the majority of people who are non-right-handed. The idea of ambidextrous, which is equally dexterous with both hands.
I can write with both hands, though.
Huh?
I can write with both hands, though.
Okay, so you're ambidextrous for writing if you write just as well with both hands.
Now, I grew up being able to write with both hands, and then at a certain point I just let the left hand go because it seemed silly to write with both hands. And now I can't do it.
Huh. Well, I think, like I was saying before, I'm actually skeptical that writing is in itself a handed behavior. I don't think there's a bias for what the nervous system has become specialized in each hemisphere for when it comes to writing. I think it's just that whatever effector, meaning the body part, hand, foot, other hand, that we learn to write with and put that effort into learning, that's the effector that we're going to be good at writing with.
And there have been studies of handwriting, you know, where people, if you practice with your left hand every day for weeks and months, there is evidence that you can truly become skilled at writing with your left hand. So I agree with Bob that it's not necessary. It may be very training dependent when it comes to writing per se.
And if people are forced to write with their right hand, even though they were naturally left-handed in writing, would it be easier for them to revert back?
That's a very good question. I don't know.
What happens when people are forced, this happened to the generation of people who are probably between 50 and 90 years old right now.
But and it still happens in a lot of countries around the world.
Yes, there's still a lot of forced right-hand use when people are left-handers. And what happens is Claire Porak, also at Penn State University, has done a lot of work in this area, and it turns out that these people will learn to do the task that they're forced to do with their right hand, but they'll continue to do other things like throwing, like opening jars and so forth, with the hand that they're not forced to write with. And so it doesn't seem to be something that generalizes to other tasks that we call hand.
It would be consistent with that brain imaging study I mentioned before.
Absolutely.
And, you know, some cultures, you know, I mean, I think this is true that in polo, you're not allowed to hold the mallet with your left hand. So if you're left-handed, you're going to have to play polo with your right. It's considered cheating to switch. So there are many cultural things that just really are biased against left-handed.
No wonder I was never good at polo.
Yeah, I know.
Nancy, hi, you're on. Please explain.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I understand from dancers and from figure skaters that they will often have a predominant leg or foot. Does that always correspond with the hand for which they're dominant, or does that really work independently?
Well, the jury's out on that. There's been some good reviews of biomechanical studies where people have looked at standing posture, kicking, stepping, lead foot for stepping. And it turns out that for the most part, your leg that's on the same side as your non-dominant hand is the one that you tend to use as a postural leg. So if you're standing for a long time, you'll tend to lean on that leg. It's not that biomechanically surprising, because when you tend to reach out and manipulate things with your dominant arm, you need to shift your weight over to the opposite side anyhow. But whether or not there's a dominance in the legs, I think, is something that's really hasn't been well determined.
It's not very well correlated. I mean, I think skateboarders and people like that and skiers, you often have to sort of have somebody sort of run and skid and then see what leg they lead on the skid with and to get a sense of what side they're dominant with their leg. And that doesn't always correlate well with which arm you're dominant with, which one you'll lead with when you skid or slide or skateboard. Mm-hmm. So it, at the moment, it doesn't seem like it's hugely correlated.
But with dancing,
it should be emphasized that control of your arms, the kinds of things that we tend to look at with your arms, tend to be associated with lots of cortical activity. And a lot of the tasks that we do with our legs, like walking and running, mostly ambulation tasks, are handled in large part by spinal circuits. And there doesn't seem to be the same sort of lateralization of spinal circuitry as there is in the,
exactly,
the cerebral cortex.
Now, we got a call from someone who was forced to leave, who said he's a little league coach, and he's seeing more and more kids who are left-handed, wonders whether the cultural acceptance of left-handedness has led to that.
That's very interesting. Claire Porak had recently done a study where she investigated, you hear... There's been sort of a urban legend running around that left-handers tend to die earlier. And I remember reading on a bathroom wall on a little paper, for amusement in a restaurant, that left-handers die more frequently doing right-handed things than vice versa.
Driving, and, especially.
And, yeah, this myth came from a study that was done that showed that as people age, as the population ages, there's less and less left-handers. Claire Porak recently showed that, in fact, we're not losing left-handers. It's just that what we've done is something that you talked about before. We stopped forcing people to be right-handed when they were really left-handed. So when you look at 80-year-olds, you're looking at a lot of people who write with their right hand but were natural left-handers.
We have to leave it there, unfortunately, because we've run out of time, but it's been a lot of fun talking to both of you, Robert L. Sainberg, an associate professor of kinesiology and neurology and director of the Movement Neuroscience Laboratory at Penn State, and John Krakauer, an associate professor of neurology and co-director of the Motor Performance Laboratory at Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons. Thank you both so much
for
being with us today.
Thank you.
Bye.
On On Monday's show, New Yorker music critic Alex Ross looks at some unexpected links he finds between 20th century music, like the sounds Sibelius and Coltrane share. Then Diane Ackerman with the true story of how the Warsaw Zoo's director and his wife sheltered some 300 Jews and Polish resistors. Plus, the long history of whaling in America. And Sir David Frost with his side of the story of interviewing Richard Nixon in the 1970s. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English and Blake Neshek. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Tess Hartman, Jacob Stevens, Jennifer Keeney-Sendro, and contributing producer Bonnie Lefebvre. Debbie Darcy was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.